This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents Warhorse by Michael Morpurgo, read by Luke Treadaway. Author's note. In the old school they now use for the village hall, below the clock that has stood always at 10:01, hangs a small dusty painting of a horse. He stands a splendid red bay with a remarkable white cross emblazoned on his forehead, and with four perfectly matched white socks. He looks wistfully out of the picture, his ears pricked forward, his head turned, as if he has just noticed us standing there. To many who glance up at it casually, as they might do when the hall is opened up for parish meetings, for harvest suppers or evening socials, it is merely a tarnished old oil painting of some unknown horse by a competent but anonymous artist. To them the picture is so familiar that it commands little attention, but those who look more closely will see, written in fading black copperplate writing across the bottom of the bronze frame, Joey. Painted by Captain James Nichols, autumn 1914. Some in the village, only a very few now and fewer as each year goes by, remember Joey as he was. His story is written so that neither he nor those who knew him, nor the war they lived and died in, will be forgotten. Chapter 1. My earliest memories are a confusion of hilly fields and dark, damp stables and rats that scampered along the beams above my head. But I remember well enough the day of the horse sale. The terror of it stayed with me all my life. I was not yet 6 months old, a gangling, leggy colt who had never been further than a few feet from his mother. We were parted that day in the terrible hubbub of the auction ring, and I was never to see her again. She was a fine, working farm horse, getting on in years but with all the strength and stamina of an Irish draft horse quite evident in her fore and hind quarters. She was sold within minutes, and before I could follow her through the gate she was whisked out of the ring and away. But somehow I was more difficult to dispose of. Perhaps it was the wild look in my eye as I circled the ring in a desperate search for my mother, or perhaps it was that none of the farmers and gypsies there were looking for a spindly-looking, half-thoroughbred colt. But whatever the reason, they were a long time haggling over how little I was worth before I heard the hammer go down and I was driven out through the gates and into a pen outside. "Not bad for 3 guineas, is he? Hurry, my little firebrand, not bad at all." The voice was harsh and thick with drink, and it belonged quite evidently to my owner. I shall not call him my master, for only one man was ever my master. My owner had a rope in his hand and was clambering into the pen, followed by 3 or 4 of his red-faced friends. Each one carried a rope. They had taken off their hats and jackets and rolled up their sleeves, and they were all laughing as they came towards me. I had as yet been touched by no man, and backed away from them until I felt the bars of the pen behind me and could go no further. They seemed to lunge at me all at once, but they were slow and I managed to slip past them and into the middle of the pen, where I turned to face them again. They had stopped laughing now. I screamed for my mother and heard her reply echoing in the far distance. It was towards that cry that I bolted, half charging, half jumping the rail, so that I caught my off foreleg as I tried to clamber over and was stranded there. I was grabbed roughly by the mane and tail and felt a rope tighten around my neck before I was thrown to the ground and held there with a man sitting, it seemed, on every part of me. I struggled until I was weak, kicking out violently every time I felt them relax, but they were too many and too strong for me. I felt the halter slip over my head and tighten around my neck and face.
"So you're quite a fighter, are you?"
said my owner, tightening the rope and smiling through gritted teeth.
"I like a fighter, but I'll break you one way or the other. Quite the little fighting cock you are, but you'll be eating out of my hand quick as a twig."
I was dragged along the lanes, tied on a short rope to the tailboard of a farm cart so that every twist and turn wrenched at my neck. By the time we reached the farm lane and rumbled over the bridge into the stable yard that was to become my home, I was soaked with exhaustion and the halter had rubbed my face raw. My one consolation as I was hauled into the stables that first evening was the knowledge that I was not alone. The old horse that had been pulling the cart all the way back from the market was led into the stable next to mine. As she went in, she stopped to look over my door and nickered gently. I was about to venture away from the back of my stable when my new owner brought his crop down on her side with such a vicious blow that I recoiled once again and huddled into the corner against the wall.
"Get in there, you old rat bag!" he bellowed. "Proper nuisance you are, Zoe, and I don't know teaching this young and your old tricks!"
But in that short moment I had caught a glimpse of kindness and sympathy from the old mare that cooled my panic and soothed my spirit. I was left there with no water and no food, while he stumbled off across the cobbles and up into the farmhouse beyond. There was a sound of slamming doors and raised voices before I heard footsteps running back across the yard and excited voices coming closer. Two heads appeared at my door. One was that of a young boy, who looked at me for a long time, considering me carefully before his face broke into a beaming smile.
"Mother," he said deliberately, "that will be a wonderful and brave horse. Look how he holds his head." And then, "Look at him, Mother. He's wet through to the skin. I'll have to rub him down."
"But your father said to leave me, Albert," said the boy's mother. "Said it'll do him good to be left alone. He told you not to touch him."
"Mother," said Albert, slipping back the bolts on the stable door, "when father's drunk, he don't know what he's saying or what he's doing. He's always drunk on market days. He told me often enough not to pay him any account when he's like that. You feed up old Zoe, Mother, while I see to him."
"Oh, isn't he grand, Mother? He's red almost. He's Red Bay, you'd call him, wouldn't you? And that cross down his nose is perfect. Have you ever seen a horse with a white cross like that? Have you ever seen such a thing? I shall ride this horse when he's ready. I shall ride him everywhere, and there won't be an horse to touch him, not in the old parish, not in the old county."
"You're barely past 13, Albert," said his mother from the next stable. "He's too young, and you're too young, and anyway, father says you're not to touch him, so don't come crying to me if he catches you in there."
"But why the devil did he buy him, Mother?" Albert asked. "It was a calf we wanted, wasn't it? That's what he went into market for, wasn't it? A calf to suckle old Celandine?"
"I know. Dear, your father's not himself when he's like that," his mother said softly. "He says that Farmer Easton was bidding for the horse, and you know what he thinks of that man after the banning over the fencing. I should imagine he bought it just to deny him. Well, that's what it looks like to me."
"Well, I'm glad he did, Mother," said Albert, walking slowly towards me, pulling off his jacket. "Drunk or not, it's the best thing he ever did."
"Don't speak like that about your father, Albert. He's been through a lot. It's not right," said his mother. But her words lacked conviction.
Albert was about the same height as me and talked so gently as he approached that I was immediately calmed and not a little intrigued, and so stood where I was against the wall. I jumped at first when he touched me, but could see at once that he meant me no harm. He smoothed my back first and then my neck, talking all the while about what a fine time we would have together, how I would grow up to be the smartest horse in the whole wide world, and how we would go out hunting together. After a bit, he began to rub me gently with his coat. He rubbed me until I was dry and then dabbed salted water onto my face where the skin had been rubbed raw. He brought in some sweet hay and a bucket of cool, deep water. I did not believe he stopped talking all the time. As he turned to go out of the stable, I called out to him to thank him, and he seemed to understand, for he smiled broadly and stroked my nose.
"We'll get along, you and I," he said kindly. "I should call you Joey, only because it rhymes with Zoe, and maybe because it suits you. I'll be out again in the morning, and don't worry, I'll look after you. I promise you that. Sweet dreams, Joey." "You should never talk to horses, Albert," said his mother from outside. "They never understand you. They're stupid creatures, obstinate and stupid. That's what your father says, and he's known horses all his life."
"Father just doesn't understand them," said Albert. "I think he's frightened of them."
I went over to the door and watched Albert and his mother walking away and up into the darkness. I knew then that I'd found a friend for life, and there was an instinctive and immediate bond of trust and affection between us. Next to me, old Zoe leant over her door to try to touch me, but our noses would not quite meet. Chapter 2. Through the long, hard winters and hazy summers that followed, Albert and I grew up together. A yearling colt and a young lad have more in common than awkward gawkishness. Whenever he was not at school in the village or out at work with his father on the farm, he would lead me out over the fields and down to the flat thistly marsh by the Torridge River. Here, on the only level ground on the farm, he began my training, just walking and trotting me up and down, and later on lunging me first one way and then the other. On the way back to the farm, he would allow me to follow on at my own speed, and I learned to come at his whistle, not out of obedience, but because I always wanted to be with him. His whistle imitated the stuttering call of an owl. It was a call I never refused and would never forget. Old Zoe, my only other companion, was often away all day ploughing and harrowing, cutting and turning out on the farm, and so I was left on my own much of the time. Out in the fields in the summertime, this was bearable because I could always hear her working and call out to her from time to time, but shut in the loneliness of the stable in the winter, all day could pass without seeing or hearing a soul unless Albert came for me. As Albert had promised, it was he who cared for me and protected me all he could from his father. And his father did not turn out to be the monster I'd expected. Most of the time he ignored me, and if he did look me over, it was always from a distance. From time to time he could even be quite friendly, but I was never quite able to trust him, not after our first encounter. I would never let him come too close, and would always back off and shy away to the other end of the field and put old Zoe between us. On every Tuesday, however, Albert's father could still be relied upon to get drunk, and on his return, Albert would often find some pretext to be with me to ensure that he never came near me. On one such autumn evening, about 2 years after I came to the farm, Albert was up in the village church ringing the bells. As a precaution, he had put me in the stable with old Zoe, as he always did on Tuesday evenings. "You'll be safer together. Father won't come in and bother you, not if you're together," he'd say, and then he'd lean over the stable door and lecture us about the intricacies of bell ringing and how he had been given the big tenor bell because they thought he was man enough already to handle it, and that in no time he'd be the biggest lad in the village. My Albert was proud of his bell ringing prowess, and as Zoe and I stood head to tail in the darkening stable, lulled by the 6 bells ringing out over the dusky fields from the church, we knew he had every right to be proud. It is the noblest of music, for everyone can share it. They have only to listen. I must have been standing asleep, for I do not recall hearing him approach, but quite suddenly there was the dancing light of a lantern at the stable door and the bolts were pulled back. I thought at first it might be Albert, but the bells were still ringing, and then I heard the voice that was unmistakably that of Albert's father on a Tuesday night after market. He hung the lantern above the door and came towards me. There was a whippy stick in his hand, and he was staggering around the stable towards me.
"So, my proud little devil," he said, the threat in his voice quite undisguised. "I've a bet on, though I can't have you pulling a plough in so to week. Farmer Easton and the others at the George think I can't handle you, but I'll show 'em. You've been mollycoddled enough, and the time has come for you to earn your keep. I'm going to try some collars on you this evening and find one that fits, and then tomorrow we'll start ploughing. Now, we can do this a nice way or a nasty way. Give me trouble, and I'll whip you till you bleed."
Old Zoe knew his mood well enough and whinnied her warning, backing off into the dark recesses of the stable, but she need not have warned me, for I sensed his intention. One look at the raised stick sent my heart thumping wildly with fear. Terrified, I knew I could not run, for there was nowhere to go, so I put my back to him and lashed out behind me. I felt my hooves strike home. I heard a cry of pain and turned to see him crawling out of the stable door, dragging one leg stiffly behind him and muttering words of cruel vengeance. That next morning, both Albert and his father came out together to the stables. His father was walking with a pronounced limp. They were carrying a collar each, and I could see that Albert had been crying, for his pale cheeks were stained with tears. They stood together at the stable door. I noticed with infinite pride and pleasure that my Albert was already taller than his father, whose face was drawn and lined with pain.
"If your mother hadn't begged me last night, Albert, I'd have shot that horse on the spot. He could have killed me. Now, I'm warning you, if that animal is not ploughing straight as an arrow inside a week, he'll be sold on, and that's a promise. It's up to you. You say you can deal with him, and I'll give you just one chance. You won't let me go near him. He's wild and vicious, and unless you make it your business to tame him and train him inside that week, he's going. Do you understand? That horse has to earn his keep like everyone else round here. I don't care how showy he is. That horse has got to learn how to work. And I'll promise you another thing, Albert. If I have to lose that bet, then he has to go.
He dropped the collar on the ground and turned on his heel to go.
Father, said Albert, with resolution in his voice, I'll train Joey. I'll train him to plough all right. But you must promise never to raise a stick to him again. He can't be handled that way. I know him, Father. I know him as if he were my own brother.
You train him, Albert. You handle him. Don't care how you do it. I don't want to know, said his father dismissively.
I'll not go near the brute again. I'll shoot him first.
But when Albert came into the stable, it was not to smooth me as he usually did, nor talk to me gently. Instead, he walked up to me and looked me hard in the eye.
That was devilish stupid, he said sternly. If you want to survive, Joey, you'll have to learn. You're never to kick out at anyone ever again. He means it, Joey. He'd have shot you just like that if it hadn't been for Mother. It was Mother who saved you. He wouldn't listen to me, and he never will. So never again, Joey, never.
His voice changed now, and he spoke more like himself.
We have 1 week, Joey. Only 1 week to get you ploughing. I know with all that thoroughbred in you, you may think it beneath you, but that's what you're going to have to do. Oh, Zoe and me, we're going to train you, and it'll be devilish hard work, even harder for you, because you're not quite the right shape for it. There's not enough of you yet. You won't much like me by the end of it, Joey. But Father means what he says. He's a man of his word, so once he's made up his mind, then that's that. He'd sell you on, even shoot you rather than lose that bet, and that's for sure.
That same morning, with the mist still clinging to the fields and linked side by side to dear old Zoe in a collar that hung loose around my shoulders, I was led out onto Long Close, and my training as a farm horse began. As we took the strain together for the first time, the collar rubbed at my skin and my feet sank deep into the soft ground with the effort of it. Behind, Albert was shouting almost continuously, flashing a whip at me whenever I hesitated or went off line, whenever he felt I was not giving my best, and he knew. This was a different Albert. Gone were the gentle words and the kindnesses of the past. His voice had a harshness and a sharpness to it that would brook no refusal on my part. Beside me, old Zoe leant into her collar and pulled silently, head down, digging in with her feet. For her sake, and for my own sake, for Albert's too, I leant my weight into my collar and began to pull. I was to learn during that week the rudiments of ploughing like a farm horse. Every muscle I had ached with the strain of it. But after a night's good rest stretched out in the stable, I was fresh again and ready for work the next morning. Each day as I progressed and we began to plough more as a team, Albert used the whip less and less and spoke more gently to me again, until finally, at the end of the week, I was sure I had all but regained his affection. Then, one afternoon after we had finished the headland around Long Close, he unhitched the plough and put an arm around each of us.
"It's all right now. You've done it, my beauties, you've done it," he said. "I didn't tell you because I didn't want to put you off, but Father and Farmer Easton have been watching us from the house this afternoon."
He scratched us behind the ears and smoothed our noses.
"Father's won his bet, and he told me at breakfast that if we finished the field today, he'd forget all about the incident and that you could stay on, Joey. So you've done it, my beauty, and I'm so proud of you. I could kiss you, you old silly, but I won't do that, not with them watching. I'll let you stay now. I'm sure he will. He's a man of his word, is my father. You can be sure of that, long as he's sober."
It was some months later, on the way back from cutting the hay in Great Meadow along the sunken leafy lane that led up to the farmyard, that Albert first talked to us of the war. His whistling stopped in mid-tune.
"Mother says there's likely to be a war," he said sadly. "I don't know what it's about. Something about some old duke that's been shot at somewhere. Can't think why that should matter to anyone, but she says we'll be in it all the same. But won't affect us, not down here. We'll go on just the same. 15, I'm too young to go anyway." "Well, that's what she said. But I tell you, Joey, if there is a war, I'd want to go. I think I'd make a good soldier, don't you? Look fine in a uniform, wouldn't I? And I've always wanted to march to the beat of a band. Can you imagine that, Joey?
Come to that, you'd make a good warhorse yourself, wouldn't you? If you ride as well as you pull, and I know you will, we'd make quite a pair. God help the Germans if they have to fight the two of us.
One hot summer evening, after a long and dusty day in the fields, I was deep into my mashing oats with Albert still rubbing me down with straw and talking on about the abundance of good straw they'd have for the winter months and about how good the wheat straw would be for the thatching they would be doing, when I heard his father's heavy steps coming across the yard towards us. He was calling out as he came.
"Mother!" he shouted. "Mother! Come out, mother!"
It was his sane voice, his sober voice, and was a voice that held no fear for me.
"It's war, mother! I've just heard it in the village. Postman came in this afternoon with the news. The devils have marched into Belgium. It's certain for sure now. We declared war yesterday at 11 o'clock. We are at war with the Germans. We'll give them such a hiding as they won't ever raise their fist to anyone be over in a few months. It's always been the same. Just because the British lion's sleeping, they think he's dead. We'll teach them a thing or two, mother. We'll teach them a lesson they'll never forget."
Albert had stopped brushing me and dropped the straw on the ground. We moved over towards the stable door. His mother was standing on the steps by the door of the farmhouse. She had her hand to her mouth.
"Oh, dear God," she said softly. "Oh, dear God."
Chapter 3. Gradually, during that last summer on the farm, so gradually that I had hardly noticed it, Albert had begun riding me out over the farm to check the sheep. Old Zoe would follow along behind, and I would stop every now and then to be sure that she was still with us. I do not even remember the first time he put a saddle on me, but at some time he must have done so, for by the time war was declared that summer, Albert was riding me out to the sheep each morning and almost every evening after his work. I came to know every lane in the parish, every whispering oak tree and every banging gate. We would splash through the stream under Innocence Copse and thunder up Ferny Peace beyond. With Albert riding me, there was no hanging on the reins, no jerking on the bit in my mouth, but always a gentle squeeze with the knees and a touch of his heels was enough to tell me what he wanted of me. I think he could have ridden me even without that, so well did we come to understand each other. Whenever he was not talking to me, he would whistle or sing all the time, and that somehow seemed to reassure me. The war hardly touched us on the farm to start with. With more straw still to turn and stack for the winter, old Zoe and I were led out every morning early into the fields to work. To our great relief, Albert had now taken over most of the horsework on the farm, leaving his father to see to the pigs and the bullocks, to check the sheep and to mend the fences and dig the ditches around the farm, so that we scarcely saw him for more than a few minutes each day. Yet, in spite of the normality of the routine, there was a growing tension on the farm, and I began to feel an acute sense of foreboding. There would be long and heated exchanges in the yard, sometimes between Albert's father and mother, but more often, strangely enough, between Albert and his mother.
"You mustn't blame him, Albert," she said one morning,
turning on him angrily outside the stable door.
"He did it all for you, you know. When Lord Denton offered to sell him the farm 10 years ago, he took out the mortgage so that you'd have a farm of your own when you grow up. And it's the mortgage that worries him sick and makes him drink. So, if he isn't himself from time to time, you've got no call to keep on about him. He's not as well as he used to be, and he can't put in the work on the farm like he used to. He's over 50, you know. Children don't think of their fathers as being old or young. And it's the war, too. The war worries him, Albert. He's worried prices will be falling back, and I think in his heart of hearts he feels he should be soldiering in France. But he's too old for that. You've got to try to understand him, Albert. He deserves that much."
"You don't drink, mother," Albert replied vehemently.
"And you've got worries just like he has, and anyway, if you did drink, you wouldn't get me as he does. I do all the work I can and more, and he still never stops complaining that this isn't done and that isn't done. He complains every time I take Joey out in the evening. He doesn't even want me to go off bell ringing once a week. It's not reasonable, mother."
"I know that, Albert," his mother said more gently now, taking his hand in both of hers.
"But you must try to see the good in him. He's a good man. He really is. You remember him that way too, don't you?"
"Yes, mother. I remember him like that," Albert acknowledged.
"But if only he wouldn't keep on about Joey as he does. After all, Joey works for his living now, and he has to have time off to enjoy himself just as I do."
Of course, dear, she said, taking his elbow and walking him up towards the farmhouse. But you know how he feels about Joey, don't you? He bought him in a fit of pique and has regretted it ever since. As he says, we really only need one horse for the farm work, and that horse of yours eats money. That's what worries him. Farmers and horses, always the same. My father was like it too, but he'll come round if you're kind with him. I know he will. But Albert and his father scarcely spoke to each other any more these days, and Albert's mother was used more and more by both as a go-between, as a negotiator. It was on a Wednesday morning, with the war but a few weeks old, that Albert's mother was again arbitrating between them in the yard outside. As usual, Albert's father had come home drunk from the market the night before. He said he had forgotten to take back the saddleback boar they had borrowed to serve the sows and gilts. He had told Albert to do it, but Albert had objected strongly, and an argument was brewing. Albert's father said that he had business to attend to, and Albert maintained he had the stables to clean out.
"Won't take you but half an hour, dear, to drive the boar back down a valley to Thursdone,"
Albert's mother said swiftly, trying to soften the inevitable.
"All right, then,"
Albert conceded, as he always did when his mother intervened, for he hated to upset her.
"I'll do it for you, mother, but only on condition I can take Joey out this evening. I want to hunt him this winter, and I have to get him fit."
Albert's father stayed silent and thin-lipped, and I noticed then he was looking straight at me. Albert turned, patted me gently on the nose, picked up a stick from the pile of lightings up against the woodshed, and made his way down towards the piggery. A few minutes later, I saw him driving the great black-and-white boar out down the farm track towards the lane. I called out after him, but he did not turn round. Now, if Albert's father came into the stable at all, it was always to lead out old Zoe. He left me alone these days. He would throw a saddle onto Zoe out in the yard and ride out onto the hills above the farmhouse to check the sheep. So it was nothing special when he came into the stable that morning and led Zoe out. But when he came back into the stable afterwards and began to sweet-talk me and held out a bucket of sweet-smelling oats, I was immediately suspicious. But the oats and my own inquisitiveness overcame my better judgment, and he was able to slip a halter over my head before I could pull away. His voice, however, was unusually gentle and kind as he tightened the halter and reached out slowly to stroke my neck.
"You'll be all right, old son," he said softly. "You'll be all right. They'll look after you, promise they would. And I need the money, Joey. I need the money bad."
Chapter 4. Tying a long rope to the halter, he walked me out of the stable. I went with him because Zoe was out there looking back over her shoulder at me, and I was always happy to go anywhere and with anyone as long as she was with me. All the while, I noticed that Albert's father was speaking in a hushed voice and looking around him like a thief. He must have known that I would follow old Zoe, for he roped me up to her saddle and led us both quietly out of the yard down the track and over the bridge. Once in the lane, he mounted Zoe swiftly, and we trotted up the hill and into the village. He never spoke a word to either of us. I knew the road well enough, of course, for I had been there often enough with Albert, and indeed I loved going there because there were always other horses to meet and people to see. It was in the village only a short time before that I had met my first motor car outside the post office, and had stiffened with fear as it rattled past, but I had stood steady, and I remember that Albert had made a great fuss of me after that. But now, as we neared the village, I could see that several motor cars were parked up around the green, and there was a greater gathering of men and horses than I had ever seen. Excited as I was, I remember that a sense of deep apprehension came over me as we trotted up into the village. There were men in khaki uniforms everywhere, and then, as Albert's father dismounted and led us up past the church towards the green, a military band struck up a rousing, pounding march. The pulse of the great bass drum beat out through the village, and there were children everywhere. Some marching up and down with broomsticks over their shoulders, and some leaning out of the windows waving flags. As we approached the flagpole in the centre of the green where the Union Jack hung limp in the sun against the white pole, an officer pushed through the crowd towards us. He was tall and elegant in his jodhpurs and Sam Brown belt, with a silver sword at his side. He shook Albert's father by the hand.
"I told you I'd come, Captain Nichols, sir," said Albert's father. "It's because I need the money, you understand.
Wouldn't part with a horse like this unless I had to.
Well, farmer, said the officer, nodding his appreciation as he looked me over. I thought you'd be exaggerating when we talked in the George last evening. Finest horse in the parish, you said. But then, everyone says that. But this one is different. I can see that. And he smoothed my neck gently and scratched me behind my ears. Both his hand and his voice were kind, and I did not shrink away from him. You're right, farmer. He'd make a fine mount for any regiment, and we'd be proud to have him. I wouldn't mind using him myself, no. I wouldn't mind at all. If he turns out to be all he looks, then he'd suit me well enough. Fine-looking animal. No question about it.
£40? You'll pay me, Captain Nichols, like you promised yesterday?
Albert's father said in a voice that was unnaturally low, almost as if he did not want to be heard by anyone else.
I can't let him go for penniless. Man's got to live.
That's what I promised you last evening, farmer, Captain Nichols said, opening my mouth and examining my teeth. He's a fine young horse. Strong neck, sloping shoulder, straight fetlocks. Done much work, has he? Hunted him out yet, have you?
My son rides him out every day, said Albert's father. Goes like a racer, jumps like a hunter, he tells me.
Well, said the officer, as long as our vet passes him as fit and sound in wind and limb, you'll have your £40 as we agreed.
I can't be long, sir,
Albert's father said, glancing back over his shoulder.
I have to get back. I have my work to see to.
Well, we're busy recruiting in the village as well as buying, said the officer, but we'll be as quick as we can for you. True, there's a lot more good men volunteers than there are good horses in these parts, and the vet doesn't have to examine the men, does he? You wait here. I'll only be a few minutes. Captain Nichols led me away through the archway opposite the public house and into a large garden beyond where there were men in white coats and a uniformed clerk sitting down at a table taking notes. I thought I heard old Zoe calling after me, so I shouted back to reassure her, for I felt no fear at this moment. I was too interested in what was going on around me. The officer talked to me gently as we walked away, so I went along almost eagerly. The vet, a small, bustling man with a bushy black moustache, prodded me all over, lifted each of my feet to examine them, which I objected to, and then peered into my eyes and my mouth, sniffing at my breath. Then I was trotted round and round the garden before he pronounced me a perfect specimen.
Sound as a bell. Fit for anything, cavalry or artillery, were the words he used. No splints, no curbs, good feet and teeth. Buy him, Captain, he said. He's a good one.
I was led back to Albert's father, who took the offered notes from Captain Nichols, stuffing them quickly into his trouser pocket.
You'll look after him, sir, he said. You'll see he comes to no harm. My son's very fond of him, you see.
He reached out and brushed my nose with his hand. There were tears filling his eyes. At that moment, he became almost a likable man for me.
You'll be all right, old son, he whispered to me. You won't understand, and neither will Albert, but unless I sell you, I can't keep up with the mortgage and we'll lose the farm. I've treated you bad. I've treated everyone bad. I know it, and I'm sorry for it.
And he walked away from me, leading Zoe behind him. His head was lowered, and he looked suddenly a shrunken man. It was then that I fully realized I was being abandoned, and I began to neigh, a high-pitched cry of pain and anxiety that shrieked out through the village. Even old Zoe, obedient and placid as she always was, stopped and would not be moved on no matter how hard Albert's father pulled her. She turned, tossed up her head and shouted her farewell, but her cries became weaker, and she was finally dragged away and out of my sight. Kind hands tried to contain me and console me, but I was unconsolable. I had just about given up all hope when I saw my Albert running up towards me through the crowd, his face red with exertion. The band had stopped playing, and the entire village looked on as he came up to me and put his arms around my neck.
He sold him, Annie,
he said quietly, looking up at Captain Nichols, who was holding me.
Joey is my horse. He's my horse. He always will be, no matter who buys him. I can't
stop my father from selling him. But if Joey goes with you, I go. I want to join up and stay with him.
You've the right spirit for a soldier, young man, said the officer, taking off his peaked cap and wiping his brow with the back of his hand. He had black curly hair and a kind, open look on his face. You've the spirit, but you haven't the years. You're too young and you know it. 17's the youngest we take. Come back in a year or so and we'll see.
I look 17, Albert said, almost pleading. I'm bigger than most 17-year-olds.
But even as he spoke, he could see he was getting nowhere.
You won't take me then, sir? Not even as a stable boy. I'll do anything, anything.
What's your name, young man? Captain Nichols asked.
Narricot, sir, Albert Narricot.
Well, Mr. Narricot, I'm sorry I can't help you. The officer shook his head and replaced his cap. I'm sorry, young man, regulations. But don't you worry about your Joey. I shall take good care of him until you're ready to join us. You've done a fine job on him. You should be proud of him. He's a fine, fine horse. But your father needed the money for the farm. And a farm won't run without money. You must know that. I like your spirit. So, when you're old enough, you must come and join the yeomanry. We shall need men like you, and it will be a long war, I fear, longer than people think. Mention my name. I'm Captain Nichols, and I'd be proud to have you with us.
There's no way, then? Albert asked. There's nothing I can do.
Nothing, said Captain Nichols. Your horse belongs to the army now, and you're too young to join up. Don't you worry. We'll look after him. I'll take personal care of him, and that's a promise.
Albert wriggled my nose for me, as he often did, and stroked my ears. He was trying to smile, but could not.
I'll find you again, you old silly, he said quietly. Wherever you are, I'll find you, Joey.
Take good care of him, please, sir, till I find him again. There's not another horse like him, not in the old world. You'll find that out. So you promise?
I promise, said Captain Nichols. I'll do everything I can. And Albert turned and went away through the crowd until I could see him no more. Chapter 5. In the few short weeks before I went off to war, I was to be changed from a working farm horse into a cavalry mount. It was no easy transformation, for I resented deeply the tight disciplines of the riding school and the hard, hot hours out on manoeuvres on the plain. Back at home with Albert, I had revelled in the long rides along the lanes and over the fields, and the heat and the flies had not seemed to matter. I had loved the aching days of ploughing and harrowing alongside Zoe, but that was because there had been a bond between us of trust and devotion. Now there were endless, tedious hours circling the school. Gone was the gentle snaffle bit that I was used to, and in its place was an uncomfortable, cumbersome Weymouth that snagged the corners of my mouth and infuriated me beyond belief. But it was my rider that I disliked more than anything in my new life. Corporal Samuel Perkins was a hard, gritty little man, an ex-jockey whose only pleasure in life seemed to be the power he could exert over a horse. He was universally feared by all troopers and horses alike. Even the officers, I felt, went in trepidation of him, for he knew, it seemed, all there was to know about horses and had the experience of a lifetime behind him. And he rode hard and heavy-handed. With him, the whip and the spurs were not just for show. He would never beat me or lose his temper with me. Indeed, sometimes when he was grooming me, I think maybe he quite liked me, and I certainly felt for him a degree of respect, but this was based on fear and not love. In my anger and unhappiness, I tried several times to throw him off, but never succeeded. His knees had a grip of iron, and he seemed instinctively to know what I was about to do. My only consolation in those early days of training were the visits of Captain Nichols every evening to the stables. He alone seemed to have the time to come and talk to me as Albert had done before. Sitting on an upturned bucket in the corner of my stable, a sketchbook on his knees, he would draw me as he talked. "I've done a few sketches of you now," he said one evening, "and when I've finished this one, I'll be ready to paint a picture of you. It won't be Stubbs. It'll be better than Stubbs, because Stubbs never had a horse as beautiful as you to paint. I can't take it with me to France. No point, is there? So I'm going to send it off to your friend Albert, just so that he'll know that I meant what I said when I promised I would look after you." He kept looking up and down at me as he worked, and I longed to tell him how much I wished he would take over my training himself, and how hard the corporal was, and how my sides hurt and my feet hurt. "To be honest with you, Joey, I hope this war will be over before he's old enough to join us, because you mark my words, it's going to be nasty. Very nasty indeed. Back in the mess, they're all talking about how they'll set about Jerry. How the cavalry will smash through them and throw them clear back to Berlin before Christmas. It's just Jamie and me. We're the only ones that don't agree, Joey. We have our doubts, I can tell you that. We have our doubts. None of them in there seem to have heard of machine guns and artillery. I tell you, Joey, one machine gun operated right could wipe out an entire squadron of the best cavalry in the world, German or British. I mean, look what happened to the light brigade at Balaclava when they took on the Russian guns. None of them seem to remember that. And the French learnt the lesson in the Franco-Prussian War. But you can't say anything to them, Joey. If you do, they'll call you defeatist or some such rubbish. I honestly think that some of them in there only want to win this war if the cavalry can win it." He stood up, tucked his sketchbook under his arm, and came over towards me and tickled me behind the ears. "You like that old sun, don't you? Below all that fire and brimstone, you're a soppy old date at heart. Come to think of it, we have a lot in common, you and I. First, we don't much like it here, and would rather be somewhere else. Second, we've neither of us ever been to war. Never even heard a shot fired in anger, have we? I just hope I'm up to it when the time comes. That's what worries me more than anything, Joey. Because I tell you, and I haven't even told Jamie this, I'm frightened as hell. So you'd better have enough courage for the two of us." A door banged across the yard, and I heard the familiar sound of boots crisp on the cobbles. It was Corporal Samuel Perkins passing along the lines of stables on his evening rounds, stopping at each one to check until at last he came to mine. "Good evening, sir," he said, saluting smartly. "Sketching again?" "Doing my best, Corporal," said Captain Nichols, "doing my best to do him justice. Is he not the finest mount in the entire squadron? I've never seen a horse so well put together as he is, have you?" "Oh, he's special enough to look at, sir," said the corporal of horse. Even his voice put my ears back. There was a thin, acid tone to it that I dreaded. "I grant you that, but looks aren't everything, are they, sir? There's always more to an horse than meets the eye. Isn't that right, sir? How should I put it, sir?"
"However you like, Corporal," said Captain Nichols somewhat frostily. "But be careful what you say, for that's my horse you're speaking about, so take care."
"Let's say I feel he has a mind of his own. Yeah, let's put it that way. He's good enough out on manoeuvres, a real stayer, one of the very best, but inside the school, sir, he's a devil, and a strong devil too. Never been properly schooled, sir, you can tell that. Farm horse he is, and farm trained. If he's to make a cavalry horse, sir, he'll have to learn to accept the disciplines. He has to learn to obey instantly and instinctively. You don't want a prima donna under you when the bullets start flying."
"Fortunately, Corporal," said Captain Nichols, "fortunately, this war will be fought out of doors and not indoors. I asked you to train Joey because I think you are the best man for the job. There's no one better in the squadron, but perhaps you should ease up on him just a bit. You've got to remember where he came from. He's a willing soul. He just needs a bit of gentle persuasion, that's all. But keep it gentle, Corporal. Keep it gentle. I don't want him soured. This horse is going to carry me through the war, and with any luck, out the other side of it. He's special to me, Corporal. You know that, so make sure you look after him as if he were your own, won't you? We leave for France in under a week now. If I had the time, I'd be schooling him on myself, but I'm far too busy trying to turn troopers into mounted infantry. A horse may carry you through, Corporal, but he can't do your fighting for you. And there's some of them still think they'll only be needing their sabres when they get out there. Some of them really believe that flashing their sabres around will frighten Jerry all the way home. I tell you that they have got to learn to shoot straight. We'll all have to learn to shoot straight if we want to win this war. Yes, sir, said the Corporal with a new respect in his voice. He was more meek and mild now than I had ever seen him. And, Corporal, said Captain Nichols, walking towards the stable door, I'd be obliged if you'd feed Joey up somewhat. He's lost a bit of condition, gone back a bit, I'd say. I shall be taking him out myself on final manoeuvres in 2 or 3 days, and I want him fit and shining. He's to look the best in the squadron. It was only in that last week of my military education that I began at last to settle into the work. Corporal Samuel Perkins seemed less harsh towards me after that evening. He used the spurs less and gave me more rein. We did less work now in the school and more formation work on the open plains outside the camp. I took the Weymouth bit more readily now and began to play with it between my teeth, as I had always done with the snaffle. I began to appreciate the good food and the grooming and the buffing up, all the unending attention and care that was devoted to me. As the days passed, I began to think less and less of the farm and old Zoe and of my early life. But Albert, his face and his voice stayed clear in my mind despite the unerring routine of the work that was turning me imperceptibly into an army horse. By the time Captain Nichols came to take me out on those last manoeuvres before we went to war, I was already quite resigned to, even contented, in my new life. Dressed now in field service marching order, Captain Nichols weighed heavy on my back as the entire regiment moved out onto Salisbury Plain. I remember mostly the heat and the flies that day, for there were hours of standing about in the sun waiting for things to happen. Then, with the evening sun spreading and dying along the flat horizon, the entire regiment lined up in echelon for the charge, the climax of our last manoeuvres. The order was given to draw swords, and we walked forward. As we waited for the bugle calls, the air was electric with anticipation. It passed between every horse and his rider, between horse and horse, between trooper and trooper. I felt inside me a surge of such excitement that I found it difficult to contain myself. Captain Nichols was leading his troop, and alongside him rode his friend Captain Jamie Stewart on a horse I had never seen before. He was a tall, shining black stallion. As we walked forward, I glanced up at him and caught his eye. He seemed to acknowledge it briefly. The walk moved into a trot and then into a canter. I heard the bugles blow and caught sight of his sabre pointing over my right ear. Captain Nichols leant forward in the saddle and urged me into a gallop. The thunder and the dust and the roar of men's voices in my ears took a hold of me and held me at a pitch of exhilaration I had never before experienced. I flew over the ground way out ahead of the rest of them except for one. The only horse to stay with me was the shining black stallion. Although nothing was said between Captain Nichols and Captain Stewart, I felt it suddenly important that I should not allow this horse to get ahead of me. One look told me that he felt the same, for there was a grim determination in his eyes and his brow was furrowed with concentration. When we overran the enemy position, it was all our riders could do to bring us to a halt, and finally we stood, nose to nose, blowing and panting, with both captains breathless with exertion. "You see, Jamie, I told you so," said Captain Nichols, and there was such pride in his voice as he spoke. "This is the horse I was telling you about, found in deepest Devon. And if we had gone on much longer, your Topthorne would have been struggling to stay with him, you can't deny it." Topthorne and I looked warily at each other at first. He was half a hand or more higher than me, a huge, sleek horse that held his head with majestic dignity. He was the first horse I had ever come across that I felt could challenge me for strength. But there was also a kindness in his eye that held no threat for me. "My Topthorne is the finest mount in this regiment, or any other," said Captain Jamie Stewart. "Joey might be faster, and all right, I'll grant he looks as good as any horse I've ever seen pulling a milk float, but there's no one to match my Topthorne for stamina. Why, he could have gone on forever and ever. He's an 8-horse power horse, and that's a fact." On the way back to the barracks that evening, the two officers debated the virtues of their respective horses, whilst Topthorne and I plodded along shoulder to shoulder, heads hanging,
our strength sapped by the sun and the long gallop. We were stabled side by side that night, and again on the boat the next day we found ourselves together in the bowels of the converted liner that was to carry us off to France and away to the war. Chapter 6. There was all about us on the ship an air of great exuberance and expectancy. The soldiers were buoyant with optimism, as if they were embarking on some great military picnic. It seemed none of them had a care in the world. As they tended us in our stalls, the troopers joked and laughed together as I had never heard them before, and we were to need their confidence around us, for it was a stormy crossing, and many of us became overwrought and apprehensive as the ship tossed wildly in the sea. Some of us kicked out at our stalls in a desperate effort to break free and to find ground that did not pitch and plunge under our feet, but the troopers were always there to hold us steady and to comfort us. My comfort, however, came not from Corporal Samuel Perkins, who came to hold my head through the worst of it, for even when he patted me, he did it in such a peremptory fashion that I did not feel he meant it. My comfort came from Topthorne, who remained calm throughout. He would lean his great head over the stall and let me rest on his neck while I tried to obliterate from my mind the sinking surge of the ship and the noise of uncontrolled terror from the horses all around me. But the moment we docked, the mood changed. The horses recovered their composure with solid, still land under their hooves once more, but the troopers fell silent and somber as we walked past unending lines of wounded waiting to board the ship back to England. As we disembarked and were led away along the quayside, Captain Nichols walked by my head, turning his eyes out to sea so that no one should notice the tears in them. The wounded were everywhere, on stretchers, on crutches, in open ambulances, and etched on every man was the look of wretched misery and pain. They tried to put a brave face on it, but even the jokes and quips they shouted out as we passed were heavy with gloom and sarcasm. No sergeant major, no enemy barrage could have silenced a body of soldiers as effectively as that terrible sight, for here, for the first time, the men saw for themselves the kind of war they were going into, and there was not a single man in the squadron who seemed prepared for it. Once out into the flat, open country, the squadron threw off its unfamiliar shroud of despondency and regained its jocular spirits. The men sang again in their saddles and laughed amongst